This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to tell you about a new book that I've really been enjoying. We're previewing now the annual Rochester Jewish Book Festival. It runs from October 25th through November 1st. Ben Sheehan is the author of OMG WTF Does the Constitution Actually Say? A Non-Boring Guide to How Our Democracy is Supposed to Work. Yes, the book is a little flippant and humorous, but it also has some very serious ideas about what we teach and what we don't teach and what we expect Americans to know and maybe why they don't often know it. So Sheehan is our guest now, and I want to bring him in to kind of talk about some of the themes here because I think it's timely. Ben Sheehan, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Evan.
How do your parents feel about you having a book with the title including WTF in the title? How did that go over?
Well, I no longer live at home, so I'm free from any sort of, immediate punishment. But, I think they are okay with it because, you know, it helps grab people's attention in a way, but, is also playful. But, you know, like you mentioned, the book has some, you know, serious ideas. And if I can help use this to expand civic education and an understanding of our founding document, then they're okay with us.
Ben's event with the Rochester Jewish Book Festival, the Lane Dworkin Jewish Book Festival, is going to be on October 29th at 7:30 p.m. via Zoom. And it's a conversation with Steve Levitsky. You can get more information at rjbf.org. And Ben, right out of the gate, there's a theme that I really want to talk about that I think that that you bring up that's really important. You talk about the fact that when we teach kids and subsequently what we expect Americans to know about government is we teach historical dates, figures, we have memorization. Sometimes we get into some of the stories from the days of the founders, but we don't really teach how government is supposed to work and how you can influence it. And as a consequence, we end up having an electorate that doesn't even know the three branches of government. A majority don't. An electorate that doesn't know how bills are passed, an electorate that doesn't understand how to influence government to make actual change. And one of the arguments you make in the book is this idea of how government works is like slid into classes or taught as sections of books or parts of this, whereas going back to George Washington himself, it should seem obvious that it should be its own section of teaching, its own course, its own class, starting early and going all throughout different grades. Tell me more about your feelings there.
Yeah, I mean, you put it perfectly, and I noticed this sort of growing up, and I went to high school and grammar school in D.C., and I only got 1 year of civics or government education in eighth grade, and I don't even think it was a complete year. But what's unique about this is it actually differs from how we've taught it in past generations. So in the 50s and 60s, classes like U.S. history and American government and civics and foundations of democracy were commonplace in our schools. And you compare that today with only 8 states that require a year of civics or government education at some point between kindergarten and 12th grade. So like you mentioned, we're getting all of these, you know, dates and names and sort of, you know, a timeline of when things happened. But the actual understanding of how government works and more specifically how we can affect it as citizens, whether it's serving in government, whether it's understanding who has the power to do what at our federal, state and local level, that's almost become an afterthought, and it gets shoehorned into social studies or it gets, you know, a little section of a history class. But it not only did it used to be its own class, we used to have multiple classes about it. And like you mentioned, George Washington in his final State of the Union address in 1796 petitioned Congress to create a national university just to teach civics. So it went from a huge priority even as recently as the last, you know, 70 years ago. And then today it's become an afterthought.
But, you know, Ben, I've got an 8-year-old, and teachers might tell you, look, I only have a certain amount of time. I have to teach to certain tests. There are standardized tests that we must meet benchmarks for. We're very limited. We don't have a whole lot of freedom on this. What do you want me to do? What do you want them to do?
Sure. Well, I want to be clear when I'm you know, making this point is that I'm not talking about individual teachers. I mean, if anyone, individual teachers, the ones who are the heroes in this story, who are the ones educating that and sort of fitting it into their classes. But really, the fault lies with sort of a series of what I believe are well-intentioned policies at the federal and state level that actually, you know, drove incentives toward reading and math. And we saw this in the wake of No Child Left Behind in 2002 and Common Core in 2010 and Every Student Succeeds in 2015. You know, and as you point out, it's creating a lot of tests and a lot of, you know, financing incentives for schools. So it's not the fault of individual teachers, but I look at administrators and school boards and education superintendents, the people who have the ability to set the curricula, and for them to understand how important this is. And really, in the last 20 years, we've been graduating generations of young people that have had far less of a education around how the government works. And, you know, that has real lasting consequences on our country.
Talking to Ben Sheehan, the author of OMG, WTF, Does the Constitution Actually Say? A Non-Boring Guide to How Our Democracy is Supposed to Work. There's a little bit of George Carlin in some of the sections, I find. I don't know if you'll take that as a compliment, so let me explain. You know, you joked that you're not a conspiracy theorist, that that you just want to present some information, and it seems like elected leaders don't want Americans to really know how the system works. And what the heck? Yes, I'm a conspiracy theorist. They don't want you to know anything. I'm trying to quote you, but I mean, there was an all caps section where you kind of said, whatever, screw it. I'm a conspiracy theorist. Elected leaders are happy with our collective ignorance. I think George Carlin essentially tried to make that point for a while, and you seem to be grabbing onto that a little bit flippantly, but it does seem like you think that when the American electorate is not very well educated, it benefits the people with the small amount of concentrated power.
I do think that. And the reason I think that is because I think of government's relationship between people and elected leaders kind of similar to how bosses or the heads of companies may interact with their employees. Because if you think about what happens with elections, we, you know, as citizens vote for elected leaders. We, you know, have the interview process, which is the campaign. You know, we have the elections process, which is the actual hiring of people. And then our tax dollars pay their salaries, benefits, and expenses. And then every 2, 4, 6 years, we decide if we want to re-up their contract. So collectively, we are very much like a boss relationship with our elected leaders. But, you know, if your boss has no idea what job, you know, the job is that they just hired you to do, they don't pay attention, they'd only check in 2 years after they hired you, it's pretty hard for them to know if you're doing a good job or not. And that's kind of how I think about how we interact with our elected leaders. So I do think an ignorance about certain jobs, you know, and again, not just at the federal level, at the state and local level as well, but this sort of ignorance of what these people do makes it really hard for us to evaluate if they're doing a good job at the thing that we're, you know, paying them and have voted them into doing.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about how that looks right now in this very moment. And one of the things that came to mind when I was reading your book was right now there's this national debate about court packing. And I don't mean to be condescending, because I've had a lot of reading and study to do myself to make sure I fully understand what exactly that term means when it's used, what the sort of the competing definitions, the Democrats, how they want to describe it, how Republicans describe it. But, you know, we're having like this national debate about the Supreme Court and court packing. And I don't even think do most Americans know there are 9 justices? Do most Americans know how many justices there have been historically? Do most Americans know why court packing has been viewed as a potential problem? Probably not. And I think that's why your book is making an important point. When we just have this memorization of history and names as opposed to how things work and why, we're in real trouble when there becomes a debate now and in the moment. That's how I sort of reflect it, at least right now. We'll talk about the Electoral College in a moment. But when it comes to the court, that's sort of how I reflect it on your book. How do you see that?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to understand, you know, what the intention of that branch of government was. And there's a reason that Supreme Court justices have, you know, lifetime appointments. And the term in the Constitution is during good behavior. So they can get impeached and removed, you know, and they could quit. So they don't necessarily serve for life. But unless something happens, they serve for life. And the logic behind that was so that the allegiance of these justices was to the Constitution and federal laws, and specifically interpreting what the Constitution, saying what the Constitution means and what federal laws mean? And the idea is not to have partisan judges. It's to have people whose allegiance is the long-term health of the country and its laws and its constitution. And so I think when we have the conversation around court packing, it's also important to understand that, A, as you point out, it doesn't establish that there are 9 justices in the Constitution. We started with 6 and then went down to 5 and then up to 7 and then up to 9 and then up to 10 and then back down to 9. And ever since 1869, we've been steady at 9. But the reason is that the idea of this branch is to uphold the Constitution and federal laws. And so having a balanced court is really important. And if the court is tipping to one side, clearly, whichever side that is, whether it's far left or far right, I think it's unhealthy. And I think a balanced court to interpret the long term, or a balanced court that has the long term interest of the country in mind is really important. But I do think it's important that people understand how the court can expand. It could expand tomorrow. If Congress wanted to pass a law tomorrow that the president would sign, it could change the number of justices on the Supreme Court. So, it's important to understand what the reason behind lifetime appointments was before we had the discussion about, expanding the number of justices.
Sure. And we're also facing a possible situation. I don't prognosticate anymore because I get everything wrong. But we are facing a possibility of another situation in which there's a popular vote winner who loses the Electoral College. And, of course, that happened in 2016, and of course that happened in 2000. And if this starts to become a trend, it seems to me that we're going to see a lot more momentum to make some change with the Electoral College. But let's talk a little bit about the history and why you think it's important for Americans to understand some of that history. Go ahead.
Sure. So I do think it's important to put the Electoral College in context in terms of what the intention behind it was, but also what it was based on when the Constitution took effect. So at the Constitutional Convention, there was discussion about, how a president was going to be chosen. And one of the ideas that was proposed was maybe Congress could just choose the president. And then that wasn't successful. And then there was a discussion about a direct popular vote for president. But the concern is that the citizens, the residents of the country might not have all the information necessary to make an informed decision on who the president should be and could potentially elect a tyrant. So this compromise was to come up with a system of people whose only job was to elect the president so they wouldn't be, corrupted or influenced in any way. So that was sort of the thinking behind it. But what ended up happening is the system that they chose to use for the Electoral College is to base it on the number of senators plus representatives. And how were those people determined in 1789? Senators the same way as today. Every state gets 2 senators. But back then, representatives were based on apportionment. And apportionment was done where every free person in the state counted as one. Every person serving for a fixed amount of time counted as one. Every Native American who didn't pay taxes counted as 0. And all other persons, which really meant enslaved people, counted as 3/5 of a person. And so using that as the basis for representatives and representatives as most of the electoral votes created the system where states with a huge population of enslaved people got more electoral votes. And that's one of the reasons, it's the main reason why of the first 5 presidents, 4 of them were from Virginia. And Virginia was the state that had the highest population of enslaved people. So it had an outsized influence in determining the presidency. So thinking about what it's based on, which is it has its roots in tied back to slavery, but the idea that people didn't have enough information to make an informed decision and potentially elect a tyrant. I think today we have, you could make the other argument that we have too much information and that some of it is not reliable or a lot of it is not reliable. But I do think the original intent behind the Electoral College is not really necessary today. And so I personally, and again, throughout the book, I say what I really think the Constitution says, but I separate sections for my own opinion. But I think that it's outstayed its welcome, and I think it needs to be changed.
Before I let you go, just in your final thoughts, you mentioned that you are gripped by what was created and what's in the Constitution, but you're also fascinated by what isn't. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you look at things that you sort of assume are enshrined in our founding documents, but they really they really aren't. I mean, you know, things like the filibuster gets so much attention as this procedural tactic, but that's not in the Constitution. Even the role of Senate Majority Leader. I mean, there are two roles in the Senate specified as leaders of the Senate. One is the Vice President, who's also the Senate President, and the other is the Senate President pro tempore. But the role of Majority Leader has only been around for about 100 years. So two pretty powerful elements of the Senate aren't in the Constitution, but also our understanding of voting. There isn't specifically a proactive right to vote in the Constitution, and it also doesn't say who can and can't vote. You know, I have liberal friends who talk about how the Constitution says only, you know, white men who own property can vote. That's actually not true. And it's important to understand why that's not true. If you want to expand voting rights, it's because they left it up to the states, and they did that so that enough states would sign on to the Constitution. So it doesn't say anything about, you know, voting being exclusive to 18-year-olds or 21-year-olds or citizens or, you know, really anybody. And you did see many states for decades allow African-Americans to vote, free African-Americans to vote. Even New Jersey for the first 20 years of the country allowed women to vote. And I think we lose sight of, you know, how much power actually exists at the state level versus what's in our federal government. I think the Constitution is a really good reminder of that.
Well, and a final thought on that, because it's timely. It's possible if cases like Roe are overturned, it's possible that states are about to find out and be reminded very starkly just how much power they have, because we could see a lot more decided at the state level sooner than later. How do you see that?
I think that's an excellent way of looking at it, evaluating it. And I think really it comes down to not just issues around abortion, but also climate change, gun laws. I mean, so many things are really, you know, decided at the state level. And I think, you know, if this pandemic has taught us anything, it's a reminder about federalism and the power that state and local governments have in our lives on a day-to-day basis that we may not always appreciate.
I was a skeptic of this book, and I need not have been, Ben. And I was especially appreciative, and I will hold on to the sections on amendments, because that is a very helpful reminder's guide for me of what's in, what's out, why, what applies anymore, what doesn't. It's really good stuff. It's really clever, cleverly put together. And I say that with real admiration and appreciation. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks so much, Evan. I really appreciate it.
Ben Sheehan is the author of OMG, WTF, Does the Constitution Actually Say? A Non-Boring Guide to How Our Democracy is Supposed to Work. Really structured in a very digestible way to help you refresh if you need some refreshment and refreshing on what's in the Constitution, what's in the Bill of Rights, what amendments do and don't say. And Ben's got an event with the Lane Dworkin Jewish Book Festival that's coming up. His event is on October 29th at 7:30 p.m. on Zoom. You can get tickets at rjbf.org. You can get an all-festival pass if you want for $72 for the virtual all-festival pass, $360 for the reader-level donor pass, and $500 for the editor-level donor pass. It's all there on rjbf.org. The festival runs October 25th through November 1st. Let's get a break here, and more connections coming up.